Usually it's the one that comes at the end instead of the one that comes at the beginning. But in this class, beginning and end are all tangled up together. And I'll ask an entirely different kind of question, which is, why is it that we talk about our intention after we've done what we're doing instead of talking about our intention before we do what we're going to do?
Well, maybe it's what we're going to do next.
Why is it that
I just do it for everybody else.
Okay, then I'll ask the question then at Greenville. Why is it that people talk about our intention as a way of closing a Dharma session?
So the intention of listening and like hearing the teaching then can be spread to a lot of people.
But the teaching has already ended at that point.
It's beginning, like you said.
Well, I think that doing something like hearing a Dharma talk or something like that is meritorious action, and part of our vows are to benefit beings. So it's a turning over of merit, the merit of our activities.
Okay, that's the best answer I've heard so far.
I got to make it
up. I've noticed that's true. A million answers in the naked city.
Yeah.
And then you repeat the stanza and a half that I read last week.
Where are we? Here?
The 29th stanza in the first half of the 30th. This is out of the 70 stanzas on emptiness. This is not the only place where Nagarjuna talks about time, but it's the best place in this particular volume, and it's the only one I happen to have at hand. So it's a mouthful, I know, but anyhow, we'll go back to it. Time does not exist inherently because the three periods of time do not maintain continuity by themselves, but are dependent on each other. If the three times were to have inherent existence in a mutually dependent way, then we could not make distinctions between them. But because we can make distinctions, so time itself cannot be established as having inherent existence. Because time does not have inherent existence, the functional basis on which three times is imputed cannot have inherent existence. So therefore, the three times do not have inherent existence and are merely imputed by concepts. Following the reasoning just given, the three characteristics of a composite phenomenon, which are arising, enduring, and ceasing, are unfindable upon ultimate analysis, even for you. So then a functional phenomenon, which is characterized by these three attributes, is also unfindable, in which case the functional basis of a composite phenomenon becomes unfindable. What's going on in this dialogue? It's a dialogue, first off. There's a debate going on in one of the old monasteries. And somebody has asserted something that Nagarjuna says is just impossible in regards to the view of time. So what I want to go back to tonight is the larger sort of psychological, if you will, framework that this way of thinking is rooted in, this middle way philosophy is rooted in, which comes down to us through every form of Mahayana. I want to review that for a little bit. And then I want to look at the future. I want to look at this question of intention. That's actually the reason why I started the prayer and did the M prayer at the beginning. I said the beginning prayer at the beginning because I want to talk about intention. I want to talk about the relationship of present to future. Because I'm going to make a kind of a radical assertion this evening, which is when we talk about separating sheep and goats, well, I'm going to say that the way we separate Mahayanists from non-Mahayanists is the way in which they relate to the future in the present. But that's sort of the key to, in fact, what makes a person a Mahayana practitioner versus any other kind of Buddhist practitioner. So this is totally, if you don't know, a completely radical thing that I'm saying here, which no one else has ever said that I'm aware of, actually. At least in so many words. Let me back up to the basic framework. The basic framework, again, is that the way we are aware of things is that a subject and an object come together in a perceptual process. For example, there is that which is seen. There is the process of seeing through an organ, such as our eyes. And there is consciousness. That these three things have to come together in what's called contact. And then there is a moment of cognition, visual cognition, in a moment when a form, an eye sense organ, and a consciousness come together. There is contact. That's a moment of consciousness, or a moment of perception, or a moment of awareness, or cognition, or whatever else you want to call it. That's the basic underlying construct, if you will, for how all of our experience occurs. Every kind of experience is like that. Even what we call mental experience is like that, because the mind is just considered another kind of sense organ, which has as its objects things like thoughts, feelings, moments of consciousness, this kind of thing, or other sense consciousnesses. For example, a visual consciousness, like an awareness of seeing Lorraine. If I think to myself, that's Lorraine, then what's happened there is my awareness of Lorraine has become an object to my mind, which is thinking, I recognize that person. So anyhow, these three things are implicated in every moment of consciousness. What that means is that there is no time that we experience anything when that process isn't going on. And the implication of that is that in each of our experiences, inextricably wrapped together is us, our minds, and something outside. Inextricably wrapped up in such a way that we actually can't separate the two. Sometimes I think we think that we experience an outside something without our minds, the activity of our own minds. That actually never happens. Point of view of Buddhist psychology, you never experience an object without your own mind being involved in that experience. Well, if you think about it, it's only common sense. How could you? So you never experience anything without your own mind penetrating that in some way. In texts by Nagarjuna, that process is called imputation. Okay. Because the view is that, generally speaking, will never bring sort of a blank slate mind to an experience. That there's always some kind of predisposition or thought that comes in with the experience and affects the construction of object out of the givens of sense experience. That we never actually even experience pure sense experience, but we always have thoughts that are wrapped up in the construction of objects. In fact, that we see objects is because of something happening on the side of mind. Let me take it another step then. I haven't lost totally at this point. The Buddhist view of what is going on in the presumed external world is that it's made up of a bunch of atoms, if you will, which in themselves don't necessarily take any, don't actually aggregate in any particular way that's necessarily identifiable. That it's our minds that sees aggregations of atoms as things. For example, from one perspective, this is 115 sheets of paper with glue. Except when I look at this, I don't see this. I don't see 116 sheets of paper and glue. When I look at this, I see a book with 116 pages. Okay. From the Buddhist perspective, what's actually here is just a bunch of paper, sort of temporarily held together by some glue. And anything else beyond that, i.e. transformed trees held together by transformed petroleum, anything else beyond that is the activity of my own mind. Okay. That what I read in the external world as things having value is my own mind. But none of that is actually there. We all together so far? Not complicated.
No, not physically. What is in your mind is not physically there.
What's in my mind is not physically there.
You're not talking about the contents, you're just talking about the object.
I'm just talking about the pure objectiveness of this is 116 pieces of transformed tree which are held together by one strip of transformed petroleum and covered with a bunch of ink.
And even those are concepts.
Of course. Yeah. That's right. Even those things are concepts in my mind.
You're making a distinction between things that humans make and natural things of nature, like trees and petroleum?
No. Let's take the example of a tree. If you attempt to define what constitutes any old tree, in fact, you'll fail at the task. Because the first thing that you'll do is you'll, in your mind, in defining the tree, you'll determine what is not tree in order to figure out what is tree. Okay. So tell me what... We can't see any trees around here right now, which is unfortunate. But all right, taking that branch over. Yeah, the only reason that I mean, I saw this floral arrangement over here. I was actually preferring to reach for something that was still implanted in the ground. But we'll work with what we got. How do you define those branches? How do you identify those branches? Where do those branches start and end? That's not a rhetorical question. That's actually a challenge.
So you're talking about just a chain reaction of chemicals, gases, and come together and form the branches and then they fall apart and they go back to their...
That's true.
That's just what we're... I mean, you can't actually grasp it. You can't say, well, this is it, because it has all these variables.
That's one aspect to it. That's the time-bound aspect to it. When you define the tree as, that's a tree, that's true. You're taking a moment in a long-term flow and saying, that is a tree, when in fact, in the whole flow of it, it's very hard to identify the tree. Because as you point out, there's this concatenation of molecules that's going on, constantly transforming. But actually, I had a different thought in mind. although that's correct, I was thinking of the analysis from a different perspective, which isn't locked in time. But in the present moment, it's actually impossible to define where a tree begins and ends. Because if, for example, you determine that the tree is only a tree as long as it's alive, that we're talking about a living thing, then the processes of life are integral to what makes the tree a tree.
So you have to include the oxygen and carbon monoxide and the rain and the sun and the nutrients and the earthworms.
That's right. Okay. Now, see, we don't tend to want to define things in that particular way, but that's actually the truth of the situation. Because if those things were not there vitally, the tree wouldn't exist, even for a moment. It's even more profound if you talk about a human being. Okay. For example, you can now, in modern times, imagine a human being in non-gaseous, non-gravitational space, more or less. In other words, somebody outside of a space capsule, but without a space suit on. All right, so that's a person without an environment, which is a natural environment. Do you know what happens to a person under those circumstances? They explode, right? The boundaries for what make a person, right, require all of this non-personness, literally, empirically, in a given moment, for physically that personness to exist. I'm not even talking about conceptually. I'm not talking about a conceptual analysis of a person. I'm talking about literally. Okay. So, with any living thing, you can't determine where, in the given moment, its boundary actually is, except arbitrarily. Okay. Now, we decide that the atmosphere is not part of us. But even conventionally, if we do that, it becomes very problematic. Because if we say that everything that's outside the skin is not us, and everything that's inside the skin is us, just for shorthand, we immediately run into another problem. Because, for example, we have this huge cavity we call lungs, which open out here. Actually, the inside of our lungs is the outside. That's where they work. So is that inside of us or outside of us? Are our lungs, see what I'm saying? The space in our lungs, is that inside us or outside us? Or our guts, is that inside or outside, like the hole of a donut? Is that outside the donut or is it inside? Well, the hole of a donut for most people is outside the donut. But does anybody think the space between here and down here is outside of them rather than inside of them? No. Right. These are arbitrary distinctions. Okay. The distinctions are made by our mind. So in each moment, as we encounter these presumed objects, what we're encountering is two things come together. Some sort of material something that's there, and then a conceptualization process which creates boundaries and implies meaning. And that's only in a given moment. In fact, there's actually a flow going on, a constant transformation, which we persistently ignore. But if we were to like cut into 1 nanosecond, we would still have trouble identifying a thing. In your example, you take that and spread it out over time, it gets even more problematic. Okay. In other words, I might be able to determine my own end, my death. It becomes very interestingly problematic to determine my beginning. Because if we were to say, for example, that my beginning is in my conception, because that's when my biological beginning begins, okay, then we have a different kind of problem. Because the essence of what's me is probably the genetic information in that first cell, but that genetic information existed before that first cell. So was that me? Well, you could say, well, but only half of it was over here and half of it was over there. Half was in my mother and half was in my father. Well, I'm not sure that that really even changes things any. It just means that half of me was here and half of me was there. But so where is the beginning of me? Because by my own language, I've asserted that half of me was here and half of me was there. Which means me existed before the beginning of me by common definition. It didn't bother anybody that I would say that. It made perfect sense to you when I said that, right? So you see, there's a lot of problems that are wrapped up in the way in which we define things. Now, what Nagarjuna is about in his analysis is bringing our attention to the problematic way in which we deal with reality. We assume everything is just there the way we see it. And he's saying, no, look, actually, that's not so. Now, that would be sort of quasi-interesting in itself. but I don't think of any particular significance beyond the fact that that's interesting. I can't find the beginning of me when I look for it. I mean, you could do some very interesting things with that idea. Of course, Buddhists do. But that's not his point. His point is that you can actually learn a whole lot about the way in which your mind is working by then looking at things. Because what you see when you look at things is not things. What you see when you look at things is your mind. It's not that there aren't things there, but what you see is your mind.
What do you see? The way your mind perceives things.
That's more accurate.
Things and the mind together.
That's more accurate, yes.
So,
you're right.
So
that's much more accurate.
Just,
okay. And in fact, the distinction that he makes between the functional basis and that which is imputed on them is exactly the distinction you're making. That's the language that, as it appears when he's writing, is the functional basis and the imputation upon it. So he does recognize that distinction, and I was getting sloppy.
So if you think about this guy in a capsule, holding the capsule of spaces, but not only if they are provided with the bare essentials of survival, without stimulus, without seeing this planet, without this and that, this, I mean, Sol's compounds is totally dismissible and say, is there some point there? Does that make any sense? I just get this feeling like more connection to knowing that. To be aware that everything is connected is so much more important. Just in what you were talking about, this guy in the council was like, whoa, you know, the human being is so out of place, it's not here.
I think that that's true. I mean, one of the things that I read, I mean, to be responsive to this particular question, one of the things that I read about people who go out on space missions is they don't get free time. Because their time when they're in space is so valuable, because it takes so much money, amongst other things, you know, to get people up there for as long as they're up there, but they work them the whole time they're there. It's sort of like you're going to be in space for like, you know, 18 hours going around in one of these ships. It's like they've scheduled, okay, from hour 2.5 minutes to, you know, 2.17 minutes, you're going to do this thing here, you know, and then you're going to do that thing there. And there is like the only time that's not scheduled is when they're supposed to be asleep. But then that's another kind of scheduled time for sleep. Now, there's a story. Sounds familiar. There's a story about something that happened when, in one of these early missions, whatever they were working on stopped working. They were supposed to do some experiment or something like that, and they couldn't do it. Okay. So suddenly, there's one of these astronauts who had like about, you know, 8 minutes on his hands with nothing to do, and they didn't have a backup what he was supposed to do during those 8 minutes. So he just looked out the window. He just sort of looked out the window. Wow! Like this, you know. And he had like this sort of cosmic experience that completely transformed his mind. And he just like, he has some sort of mystical something or other that happened to him. I think part of what was happening was this, the kind of structuring that you're talking about was gone. And when that was gone, something transformative slipped in. But it wasn't something that drove him crazy. That what slipped in that was transformative was the usual stuff that occupies us, literally and metaphorically, was no longer there. That the environment that usually constrains, contains, and defines was gone. And so he opened into something else. Kind of an interesting story. Kind of interesting to like you read about what happens on these astronauts. Some of them had very remarkable experiences when they were pulled out of conventional realities of the world, interconnections of things. Okay, so now we have the sense of, I think at this point, finally, we have the sense of what it is that we're talking about, or Nagarjuna is talking about in regards to what actually happens in moment by moment experience, in the way in which things, I don't want to use the word things, the way in which the functional basis, or the noumena, if you will, comes together with consciousness, with mind, to produce the phenomena that we ordinarily experience, the things that we ordinarily experience. When closer analysis reveals that there's something going on in the way of process rather than thing, and that we can never actually put our finger on any aspect of the process, because as soon as we do, we thingify it, or we reify it. We turn it into another thing, because we create a definition, cut a piece of it out. Okay. Our minds do this consistently. Now, one can take a view that there's something wrong with this. Now, this is sort of a standard Buddhist point of view, is that there's something wrong going on here. That's because this point of view is rooted in the idea that we're caught up in this samsara, this unpleasant cycle, and we want to get rid of it. We want to get out of it somehow. But something's not right around here. And we want to get out of the not right into the right. And the not right is what's caused by what's called delusion or grasping or something like that. And the way this works is that these negative concepts or negative habit patterns or negative desires or what have you impact the process of creating things and impact our relationship for those things we've created in a negative way to make us unhappy. So the view usually is, okay, you do something about them. As in, you stop thinking about things, and then you don't have a negative relationship to things. Or you stop desiring things, and you don't have a negative relationship to them. Now, that's predicated on the idea that if you were to do that, you get out of samsara into something called nirvana, the place where that's not going on anymore. Now, if you think clearly about what's implied in all of this, the conclusion you come to quite rapidly is that there's no nirvana to get into as long as there's any world. How could there be? Because the nature of world is it's composed of things. The nature of things is that they're created by our minds. The nature of our minds is that they're always creating things. So as long as we're having minds, we're going to be creating things, which means we're going to be stuck in samsara all the time. So does that mean that there's no nirvana? That there's no out? Okay. What does it mean then?
You have to not habitually categorize, or at least fundamentally understand that you are categorized.
Yeah. It means looking at the process with consciousness and discernment and a quality of freedom rather than unconsciousness. It means rather than being dragged along by the process, you can control the process. That the underlying meaning of there's a nirvana to get to, the Mahayana tradition has always said that there's no fundamental difference between nirvana and samsara, that there's no place to go to, no other place to get to, that what the point is bringing something else to what's here. So the something else is as you describe. That when one correctly construes what's going on in the process and gains control over it, rather than being controlled by it, then what's going on here ceases to be problematic. When one understands the way, for example, in which one has created trees, say, to take a completely mundane and trite example. When one thoroughly understands the way one is creating trees, then the tree itself can never be a problem. Because one's relationship with the tree can no longer be a problem. That one's relationship with the tree is only a problem when it's not understood. When the tree seems separate from one, let's say what perhaps Rev would say. When things seem separate from you, independent of you, disconnected from you, in control of you, or something you might desire because they're other than you, then problems in relationship with things exist. When that's not the experience of the quote other, none of those problems can exist. In other words, if one is, trite example again, if one is dealing with the problem of overeating, and the problem has to do with one appreciating the taste of food. Let's not get into any deep psychological stuff about families and parents and frustrations and like any of that stuff. But let's just say, you know, the problem with sitting down and eating chocolate cake is it tastes good.
Yeah.
So you want to eat it, right? And let's just leave everything else aside. And you just don't want to stop eating it because it tastes great.
Okay.
Right. The solution to the problem is not, I mean, it could be, you know, exercising will, but the solution for the problem could also be understanding where does the pleasure arise from that comes out of eating chocolate cake. Where does the pleasure arise from? Does it arise from the cake? Or does it arise from oneself? Or from oneself in relationship to the cake?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think what you're putting on to the cake.
Okay. If it's the case that it's what you're putting on to the cake, then it's already in you before it gets on the cake. Yeah, it's frosting. It's already in you before it gets onto the cake in some significant way. Mm-hmm. Right? The actual facticity of pleasure is something that arises in you. It doesn't arise in the cake. So if it arises in you rather than the cake, then it can be elicited in you independently of the cake. Right? So there's a way to generate it. There's a way to find pleasure within oneself, irrespective of engaging with the cake, is the moral to that particular story. So freedom lies in discovering that, because then one is no longer bound to the cake. Now, of course, for most of us, it means we're just going to get bound to the generation of pleasure. So that has to be dealt with in another way. I'm not proposing that we figure out some sort of way for some kind of psychological masturbation. But this is sort of a metaphor, if you will, for something else. Okay. Now, the implication of what I'm trying to convey here, though, is that discernment of the truth of things is, in fact, what freedom or liberation or nirvana is about. Discernment of how our minds create problems for ourselves is the first step to getting free of those problems. Accurately seeing what's happening, how the mind is working, is where freedom actually lies. Right? That's the way in which what has been previously experienced as samsara is experienced as nirvana. These two are non-different from each other. Actually, in the world, nothing has changed. The functional basis hasn't changed in the slightest. What's changed is one's relationship to the process of imputation or construction of things. Now, finally, we get back to time. Okay. Now, one of the things that we were talking about time last week, and that Nagarjuna brings up, is that from the cognitive side, we can't find any way to get at future, past, or present independently of each other. But there's actually no conceptual way to find any one of those independently of the other two. They're completely, inextricably intertwined in each other. I made the assertion that the way you define present is that it's not future or past. The way you define the past is not present or future, and so on and so forth. This has to do with the conceptual side. So you could say, well, okay, on the side of the functional basis, the objective, what's out there, well, time exists. Right? So this stanza of Nagarjuna's argues that, in fact, that's not demonstrable in any way at all, because you never find future or past in regards to functional basis either. What you do find is what we presumably would call present, that which is before one. But you never find future. You never find past. And in fact, you can't identify even present on a functional basis. You can make attempts at identifying what appears to be a flow in time on a functional basis, but actually you can't find it either. Because a flow in time requires three moments. And you can't ever find three moments. All you can ever find is, you think, one moment. In fact, analytically speaking, when you look for one moment, you can't find it either. Because when you look for one single moment, I mean, if the present is a single moment, if you look for one single moment, the reason you can't find it is, in order to identify it, to recognize it, you only recognize it when it ceases to be. You recognize it when it's ending. Or when it's beginning. You have to find boundaries to it. So you're back into some presumed three moments again. Actually, no time is identifiable in any way at all. All that's identifiable is the concept. Now, this is not mere... Yes? Go ahead. You have a question, Chris?
It's ticking.
Okay.
It's ticking.
You're ticking out loud. And I thought there was a question. Okay, now the reason that this is perhaps irrelevant is there is a significant question about whether or not that which we abstractly consider to be future and past is therefore any different from what's before us. Okay. See, we think that which is in the future and that which is in the past is not before us now. Okay. But in terms of our thoughts, we can't find that future or that past or identify it, let alone the present. So then the challenging question is, as far as the future and past of the objective basis, not our concept future and past, as far as the future and past of the objective basis, where is it? Is it in a future and a past, or is it there? And this is actually a very interesting problem.
Which makes there more potent.
That's right. You see, last week we talked about the past. We said, well, in fact, when I look at the carrots, tonight we had broccoli. Okay. When I look at the broccoli this evening, okay, do I see Michael Dow? Right. Do I see Leon in the broccoli? And we came to the conclusion last week that actually Leon is in the broccoli. Because the fact of the broccoli being there required Leon in some part of its flow for it to be there, just as much as it required the sun over Green Gulch and the earth here, and the water, the rain that comes in off the ocean, all those things. All those things are right there in the moment, but they're not necessarily recognizable. And we say, well, they were in the past. But clearly the rain that fell on Green Gulch in the past is there in the broccoli in the moment, because the broccoli isn't desiccated. I mean, that's the simplest, most concrete way to talk about it. That rain is literally concretely there. But in a more complicated way, we'd say Leon is literally there also, right? Because the activities of Leon, the life of Leon, are implicated in the broccoli being right here. And without Leon, that bit of broccoli wouldn't be on my plate. If he hadn't cut it, if he hadn't weeded it, if he hadn't planted it, it would not be on my plate. So he's as much there as he is across the room, or the rain is there. Okay. Now, conceptually, we can sort of work with that. We can sort of stretch ourselves around that and get to that. You know, we can look at ourselves and say, you know, my parents are here in me. Without them, this body wouldn't be. It's just inconceivable, right? And they're there right now in my genetic structure, in the information that makes me me, right? In the shape of my bones, in the history of my psyche, if you will. So we can sort of understand all of those things. But how is it, then, that we can get that? We can see the past in the present. But what about the future in the present? Why is it any different? I mean, from the analytic point of view, that we've been pursuing, we can't see that there's any difference between past, present, and future. And we can't see how it would be that if past were in the present, future wouldn't be in the present. And yet, I will venture to say that for everybody sitting in this room right now, it is an almost inconceivability to see the future in the present, even though we can see the past in the present.
But that's just because we lack that knowledge.
No.
Is there just as much as the past?
Yes. It's not that we lack the knowledge. It's that we can't accept perceiving it. See, analytically, we can pull our minds around to seeing the past and the present. But analytically, we find it really difficult to pull our minds around to seeing the future and the present. Now, is it because we have some sort of sense of the history of things, do you think? Or is there something else going on? See, you didn't see Leon cutting the broccoli, but you don't have any trouble at this point imagining Leon and the broccoli. You didn't see the rain falling on the broccoli, but you don't have any trouble imagining that the water that's in the broccoli fell out of the sky, or got to the broccoli, or came out of the earth and then, you know, fell out of the sky and went into the earth, came out of the pipes. So, I mean, however you want to do it, it's
well,
there.
We also don't have any problem knowing that it's going to pass through everybody's system and come out in the toilet.
Okay. That requires the introjection of what? Imagination.
No.
Future based on past. We project ideas about the future based upon our experience of the past. That's on a conceptual level. Yeah. Although it may be the case that it's possible to look into something in the present and without projecting into it something based on the past, you know something about the future, but let's set that aside. That's in the realm of what are called cities, special powers.
Well, for better or for worse, I think one of the problems we have with seeing the future in the present moment is that we have, and not the past, is that we have some sense that the past is defined and fixed, and the future is undefined and yet to be created.
Unfixed. Okay. But where does that idea come from? Let's pursue that. Why do we think that that's true? And is it?
You bring your experience, like you bring your experiences, your life, your life, your mother's, your father, all right there. Same as I bring my 31 years here. So everything I am is based on my experience.
Okay.
My experience is based on the past. So I can almost bring the past to the present moment. Because that's how I perceive it.
Okay.
But the thing about the indefinable, the futures that I... These are the blocks. The block is that I daren't make a step forward into trying to use. It's like I'm trying to use my experience to express a future now. That's almost impossible.
But isn't it the case? If let's do sort of like an Einstein type mind experiment. Let's try to look back at a moment of the past that led to some moment in the present. Okay. Now, if you happen to go to the movies and you see this new Richard Gere movie called Intersection. It's a great opportunity to do the kind of experiment that I'm talking about. But let's look at a moment, any moment in your mind, pick any moments in the past that somehow was connected with your getting to this class this evening. Like some decision, something you did today or yesterday or what have you, that led to your being in this class this evening. So think for a minute and try to find one. Anything. It could be trivial. It could be very significant. It could be the decision to move to Green Gulch. Or it could be as simple as, would you have rather sort of hung around the dining room and read the paper and have a cup of tea rather than coming here? You made a decision to come here rather than have a cup of tea. Whatever the case may be, it doesn't really make any difference. Now, what I'm going to assert is that the relationship between that moment and now, right, is such that what happened now was a natural outgrowth of what happened at that moment. Right? I mean, if you made the decision not to have a cup of tea but come to class, okay, then something in your history led you at that moment to make that decision to not have a cup of tea and to come to class. And so then you came to class. And so now you're here.
Are you saying that you create your own analogy with your intentions?
I'm saying that the future naturally emerges out of the present based upon the flow into the present out of the past. That's what we call our history. Or as the Muslims might say, it's written.
The reason that there's a problem with projecting the future from the present is that there are so many factors that could enter into your life that you are unforeseen.
Okay. So we can't get a clear image of what the future might look like. But we can agree that whatever is going to happen in the future, we know that that's even a very problematic statement. But conventionally, we use this kind of language now, even though we're constantly putting asterisks on it, saying, conventionally, we're saying this problematic language. Okay? We can agree that whatever it is that does emerge in the future, which is to say, when the future becomes a present and something happens, that which happens has emerged naturally as a flow out of what preceded it. Even though now we can't see, clearly get that picture of what it will be, still that will happen. So why does this matter? Okay, what it means is that in every moment of the present, we are in fact creating the future. In every moment of the present, we are in fact creating the future. That the future actually is. I'm not talking about in terms of our consciousness. I'm talking about literally. The future is right here, now, waiting to emerge. Just as the past is right here now in the form of what it looks like now. The past decision to move to Green Gulch is right here because you're here and not someplace else. Okay? See?
When you first said that, I thought that sort of weight of responsibility, like everything I do is creating my future, but also everything everyone else is doing is also creating my future at the same time.
That's correct.
And then that made me feel
See, yeah. Well, that's. I'm glad you mentioned that. Well, there is this dangerous thing of forgetting what constitutes a person and what doesn't constitute a person as we think this way. This is a dimension to the discussion that we haven't gotten into. But you make the point of why this is important. Because at the level of responsibility, if one thinks, wow, I am wholly responsible for the future, it is a problem. Mm-hmm. Because even for my future, I am not wholly responsible for it. But I am partially responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in regards to my part in which I'm responsible for the future, how do I want it? What do I want to do in the present moment? What do I want to be doing? And if I'm cognizant of the fact that everybody else is implicated in the creation of my future, what does this say about the more sensible kind of relationship that I'm going to have with the people who are implicated in the creation of my future versus the kind of relationship I actually have with the people who are implicated in the creation of my future? Doesn't this say something significant? Okay. Now, earlier on, I said something about I'm going to make a radical statement about how we separate the sheep and the goats and what makes for a Mahayana practitioner. Okay, we just tripped over it. Thank you. This is what it is. Okay. When one recognizes the limits of individual agenthood, if you will, okay, and at the same time recognizes the way individual agenthood and recognizes the way in which the future naturally emerges out of the present and sees that there's no alternative to this as just that I'm describing. As long as one sees that, then how one acts in the present has to be transformed.
Has to be transformed.
I think at a certain point you don't have a choice. Because when you realize that, you can forget it temporarily, but you can't forget it completely. That you have to somehow live with it. And I think that it's transformative of how one lives in the present. This brings us to this little closing prayer. May our intention equally penetrate every being in the place with the true merit of Buddha's way. What does this mean? It means in the present we intend, that's what makes for Mahayana, in the present we intend for something to happen based upon how we live in the present. Because we recognize that the future emerges from the present and we recognize what our relationship is with every other being that co-creates the future with us. So you see what I'm getting at here. So let's get concrete. Let's step away from the abstract for a minute. What I find is that when I'm working in the kitchen, when I'm cutting vegetables, or when I'm cooking soup, what I find is, at best, I'm performing Mahayana activity. Because I'm recognizing that the truth of the pot of soup is it's about to become the bodies of this community. And in fact, that what this community is doing is practicing Buddha's way, is making efforts to become enlightened, to act kindly, to live wholesomely on the earth. So when I'm preparing soup, what I am doing is quite literally contributing to that larger process, sustaining that larger process, supporting that larger process. Okay. So I'm quite literally creating sangha when I'm preparing food. But the field fruit is quite literally creating sangha when it's growing food. That the guest program people are quite literally creating sangha when they're generating the income, which allows us to, so you can take the abstractions out of any place you want.
What about the mind without any action? What about the mind? You seem to be talking a lot about physicalities of doing this and doing that, and that's very easy to grasp. You know, you do something good, there's an immediate response. But thinking something good and acting, there's a little quote here by Alan Watts that says, when the wrong man uses the right means work in the wrong way.
All right, that sounds okay, but I'm not going to try and answer. I'm not going to try and answer that particular question about Alan Watts. But I'm going to answer your question.
Yeah, and I'm just that's what triggered. I was like, okay, so I can do these right actions, but if my intentions are
well, there's all right. I want to shift the dialogue into a whole different kind of way of looking at the problem. There's traditionally three forms of action described in Buddhism. There's the action of body, there's the action of speech, and there's the action of mind. So what happens in mind is considered an action. It's not fundamentally a different action than what happens in body. It's a subtler action, but it's action just the same. In fact, the formulation is that body acts because of what mind thinks. There's a traditional Tibetan saying, aphorism, I don't know, that if you want to know the body of the future, look at the mind of the present. And if you want to know the mind of the past, look at the body of the present. Now, in one way, they're talking about rebirth. If you want to know the kind of mind that you had in a previous life, look at your body in this life. And if you want to know what kind of body you're going to have in a future life, look at your mind in this life. But we can cut out the aspect of reincarnation from this and just look at this in the simplest and most practical way. I mean, here, let's be concrete. If your mind is full of passionate thoughts about indulgence and chocolate cake, you have some idea what your body is going to look like tomorrow. And if you're suffering from indigestion at the moment, you may have some idea of what was going on in your mind at dinner this evening. Okay, this is pretty straightforward stuff. So, the mind, in fact, does at that level have an effect, which fits the framework we're talking about. But I think you were asking a different question. You're asking about the outcomes of mind activity at the level of mind. And that can be answered a couple of ways. One is in terms of its effect in the larger community, and the other is in terms of its effect within yourself alone. Recognizing, in fact, that there's no such distinction. Right? To make that distinction is based upon a false notion of where you begin and end. That's no different than the false notion of where the tree begins and ends. Okay. Because, for example, while we can say without too much difficulty that it's obvious that without air to breathe, you won't exist, it's equally true that without the food that you eat, taken or prepared by the community, you wouldn't exist. Or without the efforts of the people who maintain the water supply here, you wouldn't exist. But what about just at the level of mind? Because that's where your question really is. Within the context of yourself alone, what you intend with your thoughts, in fact, is what you get with your thoughts, isn't it? Mm-hmm. This is like a question of what does this mean? Maybe my last. back is getting a little strange. Maybe my mind is getting a little tired at this point. What I mean by that is, to a certain extent, what you intend to have happen at the level of mind is, in fact, what happens at the level of mind. If you're sitting in the Zendo, maybe one of the better places to observe this. Well, no, I think I want to stick with the kitchen. I want to stick with the kitchen and my experience in the kitchen. If at the level of my mind in the kitchen, I intend and I think the activity that I'm engaged in is a wholesome activity, if I think those kinds of thoughts, if I work at those kinds of thoughts in the kitchen while I'm physically acting, okay, what happens is that for me the experience of being in the kitchen is different. It's meaningful rather than vacuous. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean vacuous in the philosophical sense. It is non-tedious, non-boredom. So these are all non-boring. These are all mental experiences. Okay. The other thing, from the point of view of the Sangha, and I don't mean even in terms of the point of view of product, like wow, that's a beautiful silence, radiating good thoughts or something like that. But I mean the more simplistic point of view, something else happens in the kitchen when my mind is on a wholesome track. Okay. Now one could say, well, I blabber less in the kitchen. That's actually not true. Okay. But what I do blabber about when I blabber is different than if my mind is not on a wholesome track. Okay. If different words come out of my mouth. Now, at the level of no words coming out of my mouth or mind alone, then the question is, are other people aware of what's going on in my mind when they're hanging around me? Now, my sense to the answer to that question is yes. My sense is that the collective mental atmosphere of the kitchen is affected by all the minds that are in the kitchen. There's some way in which we sense that. Maybe I want to avoid the metaphysical levels of interpretation of that. And it's not that they're metaphysical, it's just that they're complicated to explain. So let's leave those aside for a moment. But at the simplest level, if everyone in the kitchen is of a wholesome state of mind, you can feel that in the kitchen. And each individual can affect the mental atmosphere in the kitchen rather significantly by changing their own minds. It's actually rather easy. It's because you have six people working together in a closed environment for 4 hours. If your mind is attuned in a certain way, you bring others along with you. It happens over and over again.
Whatever
that way is. And so all six of us are jumbling together, moving each other. Now, it's the reason why I said sometimes I may be blathering along and it doesn't mean that my mind is tuned on an unwholesome note. Because, in fact, it could be that it's tuned on a wholesome sort of note. I want to say note, I guess. What key? Tuned to a wholesome key, and I'm singing that wholesome key to help other people tune to it. In fact, it's one of the reasons why I don't necessarily agree with the idea of always being quiet in the kitchen. Because that doesn't necessarily make for a more positive environment. But it does require that you be thoughtful, conscious, and intentional about what it is you're doing when you open your mouth, which may be a lot to expect along the time. But nevertheless, you take that point. I think I answered your question, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, what I was trying to bring this whole class to was how to be in the present, but with a different view to the future. Okay. And this is my point is that this is a Mahayana practice center. Now, what defines Mahayana is what's called, the Sanskrit term for it is bodhicitta. Now, you don't hear it too much in the Zen literature, if at all. But what it means is that one seeks to become enlightened for the purpose of benefiting all beings, not just for oneself. That's what defines Mahayana as such, that one's activities have a specific goal, which is enlightenment, and a specific purpose, which is to benefit all not just oneself. Now, logically speaking, that's a requirement, because how can you get enlightened to only benefit yourself? There's a contradiction in that, because getting enlightened to benefit yourself is to reify the very self that you have to transform your reifications of in order to get enlightened. Okay. So you can't get enlightened to benefit yourself alone. It's not possible. All you do is build ego, which is maybe not bad. I'm not saying it necessarily is bad, but you can't get enlightened that way. Now, there's an intention here. So where are we at? Where we're at is, in any given moment, right, you can bring an intention to the actions of body, speech, and mind in that moment, which is a Mahayanistic intention, and that affects the future. It creates Sangha in the sense of Sangha as jewel, the jewel of Sangha, of the three jewels. Okay. It takes all of us, ordinary people, and at the moment that my intention is to do something which creates us as a Sangha, a true Sangha, we become a true Sangha at that moment. And in the moment subsequent to that, we are more a Sangha than we were if I hadn't had that intention in that moment. That's the way the Sangha is created. In fact, that's the way Buddhahood is created. In each moment, the intention is that there be a specific outcome. That transforms what happens in that moment. If there's all this kind of consciousness implicated in that moment, not just the random idea, okay, I want to get enlightened for the benefit of all beings. Well, that's probably an improvement over, I can't stand the sucker next to me with a gurgling stomach. But that's not what I'm talking about. Okay. I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about when you bring to the present moment a recognition of the way in which future, present, and past are wrapped up together, when you bring to the present moment an accurate sense of what is I in relationship to other, in the way we talked about, which is to say, not understanding I as ultimately, fundamentally separate from other, when these things come together in the present with some awareness, and then the intention is to act for the benefit of that all in that moment of the present because of what it creates in the future, then something really happens. Something really happens in that moment. That's Mahayana activity. That's almost the definition of what Mahayana activity is. So then there's techniques for doing that. One technique is like when we chant, may our intention equally penetrate every being and place. Or when we chant all Buddha's 10 directions, what are we doing? We're saying all Buddha's 10 directions 3 times. Think about the sense that we chant this end of it once in a while from this kind of perspective that I'm talking about. So they're there for a reason. Huh?
Once in a while, please.
Yeah. So, okay. I think it's time for me to shut myself up because I'm getting preachy. Next time we meet, though, let me talk about some practical ways. Okay. I mean, I sort of got caught up in the sort of laying out the pattern of why. But if you try and talk about the how without understanding the why, then the how is sort of paralyzed. You know, it's hobbled. It's like, anybody can recite empty phrases. So what? May our intention equally penetrate? Okay. I mean, we do it over and over again. What's the effect of it? So when you bring some understanding, then there's different effects. So that we have some understanding, so that another time we'll talk about specific things. How to cut carrots, how to bow and something different. So that's my spiel for tonight. I'm losing my coherence, I can tell that. But I'm glad to answer any questions, or try to answer any questions.
When you spoke of the astronaut in space who had some free time looked out the window and he expanded into something new. I thought of the Tibetan visualization practices where you might visualize the Buddha field or an offering that has a similar purpose or intention.
It does, and that's the kind of thing I want to talk about next week, actually. I mean, for example, said this to somebody this evening. You know, when you're in the Zendo and you do three prostrations to Manjushri, there's lots of ways to do three prostrations to Manjushri. In some ways, you're sort of bonking your head on the ground, and in other ways, you're doing a lot of other kind of stuff. And I think what I want to talk about is how do we bring our imagination to the process. The Tibetans have certainly excelled at that, but I don't think that this is completely on the lineage of Zen in a fundamental way.
Yeah,
like
a
Buddhist
sutra or something like that.
The practicing of gathas, for instance, with daily activity.
Mm-hmm.
I think Manjushri is in the Zendo, and that's kind of a story in itself. It's kind of imagination itself. We don't have to have a statue there. We don't have to do any of this. And the Zen Center, that's it's kind of its own story. And if you want to get really nitpicky about what is imagination or what's not.
Because this is the product of imagination,
right.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. I wasn't even thinking about it in that way, but that is true.
Mm-hmm.
That the present that we live in is the product of the imagination of the past. I mean,
and to stimulate future as well, or a reminder from something. I mean, if you're awake, or I don't know what, but anyway, see this, and maybe, represent, or where am I going, or what it, you know, is possible. So that sort of like stimulates the future as well, or can.
No, absolutely. I think absolutely. That's, I mean, that's why it's like, I think, nice to have, you know, statues around, pictures of Buddhas and stuff around. But that's not necessary. I mean, anything that'll do it that helps you remember. Anything will help you remember.
So you asked, one of the questions you asked was, how is it that we don't see the future and the present. We can kind of imagine or recreate the past. One thing that I experience in that is not in a way that we don't or can't, but what I might see in the future and what you might see and Pam might see, you know, and Stuart might. Then we can come into our sort of maybe some conflicts or some, you know, myriad interpretations or ideas about what convergence of this moment of all things, you know, opens up for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels to me in a way, I mean, some of it is the way I hear you talking about an internal process of using to get our intentions or our direction or whatever oriented, but maybe to speak about it or to go back and forth with others or something. It feels like that's one of the places that's sort of problematical. In the same way, maybe discussing a past event, you know, two people see the same scene and come up with the head or the tail, you know,
mm-hmm.
You can do that if you're projecting into the future too. So I'm not sure, other than orienting one's internal process, what, not to devalue that, but where that's useful or not saying it quite right, but
okay. I'm not actually entirely sure what question you're asking, but let me take
like
a stab at that.
It feels like
no.
I don't know, I think if, in speaking of the future, if you have a specific content in mind, it could be divisive, but if it's just the intention of the wholesomeness or unwholesomeness of the energy which comes up, mm-hmm. and not catching to, this is my idea of what it needs to be,
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't be divisive, and that would be more in line with intention, I would think, personally.
The thought that came to my mind, I don't know where it came from, but I'll share it because it came to my mind and it seemed like it was on the subject, had to do with the way in which the Iroquois nations made decisions. Somehow I think it's connected to all this, which was they sat around and they talked until everybody agreed.
That's what they're making for too. In business meetings, they for society, friends, the breakers, that's how it.
That's how it's done also?
Okay. Well, actually, they don't necessarily agree. Consensus.
Yeah.
So one person can hold everything.
But if one person has a veto, they wait until they say, I can put this aside and go with the group and know if it's okay. So you're right.
Okay. Now, the image that came to me in talking about the decision-making process among the Iroquois, and this may be complete fantasy on my part, okay, but anyhow, this is the image that came to me, was that what's going on in the conversation in which they reach consensus is if they're having to make a decision, they're actually what they're doing is they're making some sort of decision about the future. I mean, there's some course of action to be engaged in. So somehow what's happening is that the collective mind or the collective minds, however you want to look at it, are peering deeply enough together into the present moment to see what the future will look like based upon what's unfolding out of the present. And reaching a consensus about what seems to be unfolding out of the present. And if X happens in relationship to that, then the future will look this way. And if Y happens in relationship to that, then the future would look that way. And that somehow that X, that Y, and that present are all being discerned collectively and at some level agreed upon. And then a course of action is followed, which has as close as possible a foreseeable consequence. Although, in fact, everyone doesn't have all the information. I'm sure that the Iroquois sat around and made decisions based upon this consensus of what was emerging out of the present, which turned out not to be accurate because they're not around anymore. Right? If they had been accurate in discerning the future by reading the present, they would have massacred the pilgrims. They could have split. Probably should have.
Maybe. I don't know. Look at the way consciousness is changing now and how on a large scale people are starting to come to realize a lot of the values that they hold held were really the way that we need to be looking at things. Just like the Tibetans right now, how that philosophy is coming to really take over consciousness on a very large scale, and maybe they've wiped them out, you know. So you still don't know.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, fair enough. I mean, you could say that, you know, that the Iroquois had to be assimilated by the American people to recreate themselves in a new form as Iroquois American hippie whatever. I don't know. You know, I mean, you can. I'm not going to say there's anywhere that I can discern truthfully what's in the present, let alone the past, to be able to. You know, I agree with you both. Although I don't know about. Never mind. I have my doubts about the pilgrim. Stuart?
A rowdy bunch.
Not rowdy enough for me.
Not going away. But I think that what somebody said is quite correct, of course. You know, things could be chaotic. And in fact, in certain kinds of groups, in certain kinds of enterprises, it does appear that that things are chaotic when people have widely disparate intentions, and somehow you know, the group intention doesn't coalesce. And I think that's one of the benefits in a, you know, a community like this of having shared practice, chanting the same things, taking the same vows, and going to classes, and you know, hearing. Sharing a vocabulary for thinking about and discussing the Dharma and clarifying our questions and issues together. I think all of these things conspire to promote a shared vision and move toward coherence and unification. So we're not working at cross purposes. We are imagining and envisioning a common future.
I have to say that some people would not necessarily consider that good. I mean, there's, you know, there is a way in which some people would view that as a loss of individual choice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that there's a higher level of resolution to this apparent conflict between the group good and the individual choice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that there's any particular point in racing down that line right now, but I did want to point it out.
Well, I, just to comment on that, I mean, obviously there's an opportunity for abuse of a situation like that, you know, it develops into brainwashing techniques,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. But in the case where people are entering into it voluntarily, are free to come or go, are free to agree and disagree,
mm-hmm.
and to work out their relationship freely, then that doesn't seem to be a highly abusive situation. And also, in terms of the kind of practice that we're doing here, a continuous effort for clarification, personal clarification in the development, personal vision and the clarification of our own relationships to our own minds.
Under those circumstances, I'd say, yeah, then it sounds wholesome.
But it gives me the kind of...
Well, just to what Stuart said about the voluntarily participating in this is kind of, that's hard, for me it's hard to swallow, because some of it is like not so voluntary. My actual being here was a necessity to be here. I needed to find a way of living. That isn't voluntary, like just jumping in. It's like something was forcing me to do this.
Mm.
Do you see what I'm, it's like, it's kind of a subtle, like, okay, well, I came here and I chose to be here, but I also, but this is just my opinion, and there's been many other people that I've
yeah.
talked to that are in this environment.
Yeah.
That have said the same thing. I came here on this path, and this is what looked like one doorway to go through.
Is it forced or impelled?
What's the difference?
There are alternatives. There's always alternatives. And it's like, it depends on the context of what you're looking at. It's like, well, you're in a certain context that you can either do
it. As it funnels in to like the alternatives, and you try all these different alternatives and try and live it, it gets very narrow, and there's a certain amount of being forced through that.
Traffic police this conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, I have some comments of my own, but I mean, just carry on with whatever you want to carry on with. All right, so since I shut up everybody with no comment.
I understand what you're saying, but I think that you need to examine the meaning of voluntary. I think by saying that you were impelled to this doesn't, and saying that your actions weren't voluntary, in the ordinary sense of voluntary, in the usual sense of voluntary, that doesn't contradict the involuntary. We all have, you know, we all have our karma that propels us along, and we all have our patterns through which we continuously develop our behavior. And we're conditioned, you know, this is a conditioned existence, but within that we have a range of choices that we make, or apparently have a range of choices, and this apparent range of choices and this apparent ability to select alternatives, that's what we call voluntary. It may be, you know, you could argue that everything is very strictly conditioned, but even if you argue that way, in the vocabulary of the strictly conditioned universe, certain circumstances are what we call voluntary. Actually, I thought you were going to say something a little bit different, which is a kind of interesting issue, which is that, you know, we come here, but then there's a schedule. We don't get to agree to every item on the schedule. So having made the decision to be here, then there's a whole bunch of stuff that we have to do, and we're constrained to do it. And I think there is some question of trade-off between what's, you know, after a while, particularly the logic of being in the situation makes it feel like Like, we have to do this. It's kind of interesting to realize that in every moment it's totally voluntary. Every action, every time we get up or go to class, or it is voluntary. We do make a decision. We do have alternatives. And the feeling of constraint in the situation actually is something that we supply ourselves. And it's kind of interesting. I've listened to, you know, discussion about feeling imprisoned by the schedule and so forth. But my experience, and it may change over time, my experience with Zen Center schedule, I've always found it very liberating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes me feel very free. But some people just feel totally imprisoned by it. And it's interesting. It's the same. We're all in the same situation. It's obvious that these different takes on it are something in the way that David would describe, or analogous to what David was describing before, something that we impute. There's the schedule, and then we impute these qualities to the schedule. It's a prison. It's a heaven. You know, it's a great liberation. And it just plugs along.
An unsurpassed and penetrating perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. We have to end with the beginning, since we began with the end.
Can I ask you a quick question before we leave? About a half hour ago, did anybody else hear?